At Cool Air Products, we developed AC Smart Seal Quick Shot with professionals in mind. It's the only product on the market that's 3-in-1, with sealant, lubricant, and UV dye all in a single application. It's non-toxic, non-flammable, 100% safe to the touch, eco-friendly, and compatible with all refrigerants. It's a safe solution option, backed by years of R&D, Intertech tested, and has sealed millions of leaks. AC Smart Seal, the professional's choice.
All right, on the last podcast, I kind of went on about training and why it's important. So to start this off, guys, in the first like 3 or 4 minutes or so, I'm going to just kind of empty myself out on this subject to Tony first, who is my guest, who is probably the number one guest on this podcast, but the guy's so knowledgeable. He's got a great voice. He's got like a radio voice almost, Tony. And I mean, we're going to talk about heating startups. That is the main focus of this podcast, but I'm going to vent to him a little bit and he's going to give me his thoughts. And then we're going to get into heating startups from basically a wide range of equipment, gas-fired equipment, heat pumps and stuff like that. And Tony starts with heat pumps and we get into gas-fired equipment, whether it be boilers, rooftops, whatever. It's kind of the same thing, and there's certain things we have to check. And Tony gets into greasing as well. We talk about bearings and stuff like that, and that's really important when you're getting into commercial and industrial, is bearing maintenance and stuff like that. So this is it, guys. Here we go. Heating startups with Tony First from Armstrong Fluid Technologies. This is the HVAC Know-It-All Podcast. I'm your host, Gary McCready. This podcast is sponsored by Master, and I just finished my first central MoveAir, or I think it's MoveAir Central. I always get confused. Anyway, MoveAir, it's a centralized unit, and basically it's got an outdoor unit. It's got an indoor air handler. The customer opted out of any sort of auxiliary heat, like electric resistive heat strips, because they have fireplaces in the house, and they've also got some electric radiant floor heating in certain areas as well. So they wanted to gamble on just the 4-ton heat pump. Pretty large house. They did a bunch of sealing and stuff like that. They went from like 11 air changes an hour to about 3 or something like that after all their work. Anyway, MoveAir is available through Master, guys. Check out master.ca. This podcast is sponsored by Cintas, and they are providers of blue-collar uniforms. And everybody switches it up once in a while. I remember when I worked at my previous company, I was unhappy with the uniforms, and I brought it to the table and said, hey, listen, we need better pants. We need better jackets. Because all we had was thin paper jackets or these big-ass, bulky Michelin Man-type jackets. You felt like the Michelin Man when you walked around. So we shored up the uniforms a little bit. So if you're looking to do the same for the company that you're working within, you're in management or you're a team leader or you're just a tech and you want to bring forth some new ideas, bring it to the table. We're working with Cintas on that. We've got a promo code. It is cintas.com/HVAC Know-It-All.
Welcome to the HVAC Know-It-All Podcast. Recorded from a basement somewhere in Toronto, Canada. Your host and HVAC tech, Gary McCready, will take you on a deep dive into the industry, discussing all things HVAC. From storytelling to technical discussion. Enjoy the show.
Okay, Tony, I got a gripe and I want to tell you about it. You want to know what my gripe is?
I got to hear this.
All right. So we have new technologies coming into our industry quite often these days, right? There's a lot of flame-free type installation stuff. There's push fittings, there's press fittings, there's all kinds of new adaptions to pipe fitting that don't involve a flame whatsoever. And I have looked into them, I've tried them, and I mean, I don't dismiss any new technology until I try it myself and find out if it really works. So I put out a post the other day. Now I'm close with a lot of people in this industry, and I have conversations, a lot of them, with everyone from manufacturer reps to presidents of companies to apprentices to wholesale people. And I get the impression that training and education trumps all. It's a good path to go down. I had a comment from a guy that said he was in the trade for 40 years just yesterday or the day before, and I was blown away by what he said. He said, with all the change, he's like, I've been around in this industry for 40 years, and with all the changes that's happened in this trade, I think I need to go back to school and relearn some stuff. And I'm like, wow. I said, that is the kind of fresh sort of commentary that we need. And for younger guys to see, and even guys at his level of experience and his level of years in the trade, it blew my mind. But here's my gripe. So I put out a post about at the wholesale level, wholesalers sell products. My belief is wholesalers should be supporting their products through training. While whether they have a rep within their organization that knows the product outside and in and can train, or they bring in a third party from the manufacturer and then they train at their location or a training facility, whatever. And this was all about pipe fitting and putting pipes together with a press tool. And some of the people were like, well, it's not that hard to fit pipe. People should just know how to clean pipe already. People should know how to do this. It's not that hard. Pull out the manual and read it. Well, here's the thing. In reality, people can read a manual, but as you know, most of us are visual learners. We see things with our eyeballs, and that's how we interpret it, and that's how we go about learning, is seeing it, doing it, and having somebody there beside us showing us how it's done. So my whole gripe is, don't say we should just know how to do it, because there's obviously people that don't know and are making mistakes. And the fact is, some people are lazy. Yes, it doesn't matter how much you train them. They are going to be lazy. Yes, I get that 100%. But the majority of the people that want to do well in this trade might just be making one little mistake when they fit these pipes together. Taking them aside, half an hour of training, showing them how to do it with somebody right beside them. No, you're doing that wrong. Correct that little piece. And then have them do it a bunch of times after. Repeat it while you're there in front of them. And then they have the visual. They have going through the motions. And now when they go to the field, that's in their head. It's in their brain. And then we move forward. What do you think about the whole thing of education, training, retraining, as opposed to, hey, he should just know how to do this?
You know, in looking at it, yes, there are some things you should just know how to do. Okay. And yes, you should understand the basics of pipe fitting, you know, how to measure end to end, end to center on your fittings, what your fitting radiuses are, what your take ups are. Those are things that you should just know, because
if
it
you've
doesn't,
been taught.
Right. If you've been taught, because it doesn't make any difference whether you're using press or whether you're using solder, whether you're brazing, whether you're screwed pipe. You know, there's some real basics to pipe fitting that you should just know. If you're going to be a pipe fitter, then that's stuff you should know. However, every installation methodology, be it brazed, be it press, be it, and when I say press, it doesn't make any difference whether I'm talking about press for refrigeration or press for water, because
exactly.
The rules are still the same.
Yeah.
Or even press for steel. I don't know if in Canada, press for steel is approved by code. I know it is here in the U.S. And I know you're not a gas fitter up there, so you may not have to deal with it a whole lot.
I am a gas fitter, but
we
have a black iron press.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, so all those rules, the only difference with the black iron is you don't have the necessary cleaning procedure on the outside of the pipe the way you do with copper. And, you know, you have to deburr and all that, but, you know, you're not trying to get it shiny. The reality to it is that the training aspect of what we do, training is a continuous process. It's not once and done. You have to continue your education because technology changes, equipment changes. You know, look at refrigerants. Okay, way back when I started out back in the dark ages, according to my children, we had 5 refrigerants that were common. You know, we had R11, R12, R22, R500, R502. That was it. I mean, that was the stock and trade for the refrigeration and air conditioning industry. That's what we had. Well, today, how many refrigerants are on the list? 75, 80, 90, something like that.
Too many.
you know, and each one of them has their own unique characteristics. Now, granted, you know, there's, you know, a handful of them that are in use all the time, but that list is huge. And so in order to stay proficient with the different refrigerants and all of the different things that they bring out, you got to keep going back to school. I mean, we've got the new A2Ls, you know, they got a flammability component to them that we've never had to deal with before. And so if you don't go back and get trained, how do you stay on top of that? How do you know how to handle that stuff safely?
Yeah.
And so I run into this all the time. You know, I'd spend a lot of time teaching engineers. And if I look at the engineering community, depending on where you're at in the U.S., it's either 40 hours every year or 40 hours every other year in continuing education that you have to have. Well, if engineers have to have that kind of requirement, why shouldn't service people have that same requirement? Now, I know in the state of Kentucky, they require 40 hours of continuing education for every service person that's in a truck. Because every service person, every year.
Okay.
Because every service person has to carry a Kentucky master's license. I don't know if it's called a master's license, but there's a license requirement for service technicians in Kentucky, and they have to prove that they've got 40 hours of education, and it has to be technical.
Yeah.
Well, I take that back. 39 of the hours have to be technical. 1 hour is the same as engineers. It's on ethics. And okay. Being ethical in your job.
Gotcha.
Which, you know, is a 1 hour ethics class that you're basically not trying to rip off the customer kind of thing. But anyway, but that's not what we're supposed to talk about today.
No, we're not. And I don't want to, I mean, if the podcast will be titled Heating Startups, so they don't want to listen to us griping about training, but I think it's important. And I just wanted to bring it up quickly because I know that you have strong opinions on stuff like this and I wanted to get yours. So heating startups, I mean, you can talk heating startups from your end. I've always been more of like a rooftop guy, like commercial stuff. I've been in lots of high-rise buildings where we've got pumps and boilers and stuff like that. It hasn't been sort of my predominant part of the industry for many years, but it's been part of what I do, like maybe 20% or 25% of it. So let's talk heating startups because it's super important to get them done. And what really bothers me about customers, okay, here's another gripe. Customers wait till the last possible day where it's the coldest outside that it has been since the summertime ends and their heat doesn't fire up and now it's an emergency and they want you there that day. Well, guys, have your maintenance done for your heating done in September. Even if it's 30 degrees outside, get somebody in and start maintaining and looking at it. And if there's any problems that arise, they can be fixed before the coldest day of the year, right?
Right. Well, and I think one of the challenges is that everybody looks at heating startups and says, okay, I'm going to go do a heating startup. And it doesn't make any difference whether it's a gas-fired furnace.
When I said 30 degrees, I meant Celsius.
Yeah, no, I knew what you meant. I knew what you meant.
Yeah.
Yeah, because 30 degrees here, I've already got my winter coat on, dude.
Yeah. I just wanted to clarify that for anybody that got confused. Sorry.
Right. So, you know, when I look at heating startups, and I don't care whether it's a boiler, a rooftop, a residential gas-fired furnace, there's some real simple things that you have to do. And you can do them whether it's 30 degrees Fahrenheit or 30 degrees C, you can do all the same performance tests. You know, okay, so, you know, we're going to, you know, on a airside system, be it a rooftop or a furnace, we're going to check the fillers and we're going to grease the motors and bearings and we're going to check the belts and check all the electrical connections and check gas pressures and all that stuff. That's the easy stuff. The challenging stuff is it really performing correctly? Do you have the right airflow? And is your heating system really and truly putting out the amount of energy that it's supposed to? And so if I look at any furnace out there, I can look at the delta T across the heat exchanger and figure out whether or not that unit is doing what it's supposed to do. And so the absolute most basic test that I can do to a furnace, a heating appliance, is check the delta T across it. So here's the cool part. If I know what the delta T is, okay, so for water is BTUs equals 500 times GPM times delta T. Okay, well, if I know what the BTUs are supposed to be, because the boiler's got an output rating, right?
Yep.
I just took the delta T. 500 is a constant. It's basic. It's the pounds of water circulated in an hour. That's where the 500 comes from. I can calculate the GPM and know that I got the right water flow. Well, you know, okay. Remember in high school, you know, you had to learn a little bit of algebra. This is, you know, one of those times out here in the real world where you got to use a little bit of algebra. Same thing on the air side. Okay. BTUs equals 1.08 times the CFM times the delta T. Well, I just took the delta T across the heat exchanger. I know what that unit's supposed to put output because there's an output rating, right? Every mm-hmm. furnace or rooftop has got, you know, input and output. And the 1.08 is the density of air. So I can calculate the amount of airflow I'm moving. I don't need a manometer. I can do it right then and there and go, hey, this thing's supposed to be doing 2,000 CFM. Boom, it's doing 2,000 CFM. If I know that, then I know whether the equipment is performing correctly. And it doesn't make any difference what the outdoor temperature is. Delta T is delta T, regardless of input, you know, in, you know, return air temperature versus supply air temperature or return water temperature versus supply water temperature. Delta T is delta T.
And here's the flip side of that. If you have your CFM, if you know what it is, you'd obviously have to measure that first. But if you had your CFM, instead of trying to find out what your CFM is, you have that, you can find out versus what the stamped nameplate says. If it's 60,000 BTUs, for example, you can plug the numbers into the formula if you have your CFM and actually find out if it's outputting 60,000 BTUs.
Exactly.
And there's tools for that these days. We don't have to be mathematicians.
Right.
There's literal probes that have apps. There's a bunch of, pretty much every probe you use has its own app. And then there's MeasureQuick that works with a bunch of different ones. You can put your probes in, connect them to the app, and it will do all the calculations for you and tell you exactly what's going on with that system. So there are tools that do this for you.
Exactly. And, you know, way back when I started out.
So I've been having a lot of conversations with commercial-based companies lately, and they are undermanned, understaffed, and overworked, scheduling weeks out because they don't have the manpower to do so. And here's the thing. If you're having trouble finding people to come into your skilled trades business and you can't find the right candidates, you've gone through all the channels, check out WiseHire. They're a platform designed to help you find the right people. Now, if they're out there, WiseHire will help you do that. They've got pretty easy ads that you can optimize on the back end, and they're done so by the people that work there, and they optimize the ads for you. So check out WiseHire.com, guys, if you're looking for candidates to work within your business. So Ambro Controls is coming out with a backpack for their Oxy set, and I'm looking forward to it because it's already lightweight to carry, but carrying it in your hand leaves less room for you to carry other stuff. So throwing it on your back in a backpack to leave your hands free for other things is going to be kind of cool. So it's the Ambro Controls Oxy set, and we are going to be looking at that backpack once I get my hands on it. So look for that coming soon. So if you guys are charging refrigerant in cold weather, cold climates, and your tank pressure drops off because it's cold outside, it's going to be hard to get the refrigerant into the system if your tank pressure is low. So Yellow Jacket has a charging jacket. So basically, it's a wraparound heater. It's self-regulated. You plug it into 120 or 220 volt, 240 volt, and it heats your tank up. I used it the other day. I tried to warm my tank up on my drive. Didn't get warm enough. Had it outside a bit too long before I started to charge. And basically, the charge in the system was equalized to the charge in the pressure of the tank. So it's not going to flow. So I put the jacket around the tank, plugged it in. Within 10 minutes, the tank was warm enough, the pressure was high enough, and I was able to charge my system up. So it's a solution that works, guys, the Yellow Jacket charging jacket. Check it out.
You know, in when I had, you know, a set of analog gauges and, you know, when I started out, I mean, to give you an idea how old I am, I started out with spirit thermometers. You know, we had to put two thermometers in, and you know, instead of today, you've got, you know, like you said, you've got the probes or you've got a digital thermometer. You know, the digital thermometer I've got, I tell it T1 minus T2 and it calculates the differential for me. I don't have to do the math anymore. Now, I have not moved into the digital gauges and all the probes from the various different manufacturers that connect to an app because, quite honestly, I don't do service work. So, you know, I don't deal with that. And I quite honestly, you know, at my age, I don't want to, and I'm cheap. I'm not going to spend the money at this point in my career. You know, as we talked before we got started recording, you know, I'm getting closer and closer to retiring. So why do I want to spend thousands of dollars on tools that I'm not really going to use? But if I look at all this, it's really, really important to the startup process to verify what things are actually doing. And, you know, when you look at pumps, if you're not, you know, we've had this conversation, we've talked about pumps before. If you're not reading differential across the pump, how do you know what that pump's doing? You know, you got to have the pump curve, you got to read the differential across it, and that's how you can verify what the pump's actually doing. Well, it's no different than a fan. If I read the differential across the fan, I know how many RPMs the fan's moving. I can look at a fan curve and go, okay, this thing's doing 2000 CFM. It's simple. And service guys need to know how to do this. And if they don't, then they need to go back and go to school. You know, find one of the wholesalers that teaches classes, that offers classes. I know there's a couple of them here in Columbus that I've done some teaching for that, you know, I spend an evening. I'm assuming in Canada you have the RSES, the Refrigeration Service Engineer Yes. Society.
Yep.
They run a lot of really good classes. We have here in the States, we have ACCA, which is the Air Conditioning Contractors Association of America. I'm assuming there's, and they're predominantly focused on the non-union side of the business. And then of course we've got, you know, the different trade unions, but there's plenty of classes out there. And what I don't understand is why guys don't avail themselves of these wonderful opportunities. You know, you don't need to go to the local community college, go to the trade schools. Go to the wholesalers. And as we look at stuff, and the same thing applies to heat pumps, okay? I'm still doing the same thing. It's still the same math. Guys, it doesn't make any difference what my heat source is. The same formula works. Now, if you're doing cooling, it gets a little bit different because it's not delta T, it's delta H for total energy across the cooling coil if you're doing it cooling. So it's the delta of enthalpy across the coil.
Yeah.
But it's the same formula. It's 1.08 times CFM times either delta T or delta H. And the reason delta H is critical is because you're doing both latent and sensible. And in heating mode, it's all sensible. But the thing is, when I look at Heat pumps are a little bit different. As you well know, charge is really critical on a heat pump and getting it right to get the performance out of the unit. But what everybody's got to understand is if that unit is not performing correctly, if the airflow is off or if the charge is off, its coefficient of performance is going to be off. Mm-hmm. Okay. So if I look at a heat pump and let's say it's supposed to have a COP at 37 degrees F ambient, if it's supposed to have a coefficient of performance of 3.95, well, that means that for every dollar's worth of electricity I throw at the thing, I get $3.95 worth of heat back out of it.
Yeah.
That's the simple explanation of it. We know that as it gets colder outside, that COP is going to go down because mm-hmm. COP is not a carved in stone number. It's not always that high number. And so the thing people have to understand is you got to check airflows. You got to check charge. You got to check superheat. You got to check subcooling and verify that all of these different pieces are correct for startup. And you got to do this, you know, at the beginning of every heating season. And like you said, do it before it gets cold, because if you wait until it gets cold out, everybody and their brother now wants somebody to come out and start up their furnace.
Oh, trust me. I just dealt with that. And that's why I brought it up, because I'm answering the phone. Hey, my heat's not working. Well, I mean, can I come in 5 days? Because
yeah,
that's the point that I'm at. Because right. About 50 people before you just called me with the same problem. And I said, every single one of them, I said, can I give you some free advice? And they're like, sure. I said, please, next year, test your heat in September before it gets cold.
Yep.
And if there's a problem, we can deal with it then. I mean, because right now you might have to call someone else and see if they... I'm just a one-man show, so I cannot send three guys out and start, you know what I mean, going through these calls. So that's my free advice. But do you mind... Heat pumps are important because we're moving towards that, I think, as an industry. But do you mind if I give you my... just a bit of a checklist, very basic, of gas-fired equipment? Doesn't matter if it's a rooftop, a boiler, a unit heater, a furnace. It doesn't matter what it is, because this checklist applies to all of them, really.
Okay.
And this would be a perfect scenario where the customer actually lets you and gives you the time to do this, right? Because a lot of customers are cheap. Once you get it running, they might not want you to clean something, or they might not want you to, you know what I mean? So here's the perfect scenario here. So, I mean, everything's got a heat exchanger. We need to make sure the heat exchanger is properly intact. It's not blocked. It's not cracked. It's not got a big gaping hole in it. So, I mean, before I do anything, if it's possible to check it, I will check it. Sometimes they're not easy to check visually, so you might have to hook up an analyzer. So that's what I'm going to get to at the end. So heat exchanger, check it if you can. Cleaning, pilot assembly, burners, if it's a condensing appliance, any drainage system that has, because I don't know how many times I've responded to water in the inducer housing, right? It's like there's like a lake in the inducer housing and you can hear the impeller hitting off of it, right? Or
right.
The fan wheel hitting off of it. So cleaning, gas pressure, high and low, if applicable, because a lot of systems out there have high and low fire. And then once all that is dealt with, combustion analysis. Very important to know if the appliance is running safely and efficiently, right? And then we get to what you were talking about earlier about airflow, but this goes to if we're dealing with water instead of air, like we need to check static pressures, for instance, make sure within spec of the forced air equipment. But if it's a pump, we need to make sure that the pump is running properly, and there's pump curves for that, and you've brought that up. And then we can check our delta T, right? It doesn't all have to flow in that order, essentially, like, but these are the main things that if I left anything out, that you think I left out, you can hit on it or tell me what you think of this list I've just made.
No, I actually like your list. I think you hit on all the things that you're supposed to. The one thing that I do think needs to be on that list is check your operating controls and check your safety controls.
True.
Because, yeah. You know, we go out and we check, you know, we pull the burners and we pull the pilot assembly and clean all that up and we put everything back together again. Well, okay. Check your inducer switches. Okay. It doesn't make any difference whether it's a boiler or gas fired rooftop. Block your flue. See if it shuts down. Cause if you block the flue, it should shut the unit down on high static on the inducer fan or block the intake. Either one of them. I actually do, you know, I like to do both just cause I want to make sure that both sides of the switch work. Same thing with, you know, shut your fan off. Does the unit cycle on high limit? Now you got to be careful because some units have a fusible on there for high limit. Yeah. They're not automatic. They're not a reset. So you gotta know what you got.
Yeah.
Cause the last thing you want to do is blow somebody's fusible and then oops, I got to replace that for free.
Yeah.
So it's knowing what your equipment is. But you know, if nothing else, lift the wire. If you know it's a fusible, lift the wire. If the fusible opens, it's the same as lifting the wire. And make sure that the gas valve shuts down or make sure the electric heat drops out because we didn't really talk about electric heat. It's still out there whether we you know, like it or not. It's still there. And, you know, throw your amp probe on your electric heat strips. Make sure that you got the right heat strips. Make sure they're working. Check your contactors. Make sure they're not all crudded up. I don't know how many times I've looked at somebody's electric heat contactors and it looks like they've had an arc party in there because they're just burnt up and nasty. And you're like, how about if we replace the contactor?
I've always noticed that it's funny you bring that up because I've always noticed that anything that is like resistive, like it's a resistive load. I always find like the contactors, they carbon up much faster than like something like a compressor. I don't know why that is.
Well, if you think about it, resistive loads are instantaneous. You pull a contactor in and that load is there like right now. Whereas a motor is an inductive load and it takes it a couple seconds to come up to, not really seconds, but it's, you know, milliseconds to come up to full speed and full current draw. So it's not instantaneous like electric heat strip is. And this is the reason that a lot of manufacturers will use, they used to use magnetic contactors, or not magnetic, mercury-filled contactors, because you didn't get the arc because there was no air inside the mercury capsule when it pulled in. And the air is what's actually causing the carbon arcing. Because it's the air around the contacts that's burning. It's the impurities in the air that's what's burning. And so that's what causes the arcing. But the thing you got to remember is if you got enough carbon tracing going across there, it can actually create a short circuit current or a short across the contacts and allow the heat strips to stay energized if you get enough carbon buildup. So you got to understand that and understand that, okay, if I got one that's arced out really bad, I need to replace it, not because the contacts have gone bad, but because there's enough carbon tracing on it that you're liable to get an arc across the carbon tracing.
Yeah, carbon, this is like one of the things that I've been, there's a lot of people that don't know about it. This is something that I've seen in so much in my career where you go up to a machine and usually it's an outdoor unit because moisture I find needs to be involved most of the times anyway, because that moisture needs to embed itself in the carbon, and you go turn the disconnect on and right away, instantaneously, fuses go or the breaker goes. And as soon as that happens, the first thing I do is look at the top of every contactor, or I shouldn't say the top because not all line voltage feeds from the top, but most of the time it does on most of the systems I see. But if you look at the line side of the contactor, you can actually see terminals. You can actually see the corners of them melted a little bit, or there's a lot of carbon built up. And then as soon as you go, it's a wet day, and that carbon has built between the wires or made a path back to ground, and it's wet outside. As soon as you turn that system on, it could blow fuses. But I've seen it where someone will respond to the call, right? when it's dry outside, maybe that day they'll go and they'll replace the fuses, turn it back on. Hey, everything's working fine. I can't find any bad compressors. I can't find any bad motors. Next time it's foggy or it rains or something, boom, they all go again. Yep. And I was at one call in the summer. Tony, I didn't count, but there must have been like 30 fuses under the unit, right? Because people kept replacing them. And I looked at it, and it was a Carrier rooftop. Really, they're really prone to this. Contactors all burnt across the top. Replace them, replace the fuses, problem solved. No more fuses I had to hide under the rooftop.
Right. And this all goes back to startup. You know, okay, we've talked about all the stuff you got to check, you know, delta T's and airflow and gas pressures and safeties and all that. But checking the electrical components and understanding what happens, that carbon tracing and the arcing that can result, is just as important to make sure that the equipment's going to work correctly. If you got a unit that keeps blowing the fuses and you can't find a short circuit someplace, you better be going back and looking at your contactors and looking at them really, really close.
I totally agree.
And, you know, I've had this issue when I've been out, you know, working on big chillers and I don't have any, you know, it's too late in the day or I can't get another contactor. I mean, you're talking about a size 4 or size 5 motor starter that's, you know, 12 inches by 12 inches and, you know, it's a 1,000 or 1,500 amp motor starter. You're not going to get one quickly. And in that case, you take, you know, there's a number of different dielectric solvents on the market that are approved. They won't carry a current across them. And you wipe everything down and you wipe off as much of the carbon as you possibly can to minimize the arcing that's going to go across.
Yeah.
And so, you know, on small contactors, I'm not sure that it's worth wiping everything down and trying to use a dielectric solvent to clean the contactors off. Now, maybe if it's 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon and it's 95 degrees and you're just trying to get the customer back up and running, yeah, maybe that makes sense. And say, look, I don't have another contactor. I can't get you one because it's 2 hours to the supply house and 2 hours back. And you don't want to work that late because you're already, you know, you're already thinking about beer and pizza after work. Or you've got, you know, your son's got a baseball game or, you know the drill.
Yep.
And so if you're going to do that, make sure that the solvent you're going to use has very high dielectric properties so that it can't conduct electricity.
Yep.
You know, one of the things we used to do was we'd clean motors. We'd power them up, you know, blower motors. You power them up and you dunk them in a bucket of, actually it used to be Virginia number 10. I'm not sure if it's even available anymore, but it's got high dielectric strength. You can leave the motor sitting in this vat of Virginia number 10 running. I mean, you talk about something that really did a nice job of cleaning the motors up. That was the way to go because it got all the crud out from inside, you know, that was jam-packed into the windings. Today, my guess is people don't do that. They just replace the motor rather than take the time to clean it.
Yeah, for sure. And you were talking about when it comes to, obviously, motors run pumps, you were talking about just before we got on about how you can get the pump, if it's got a fan attached to it to cool it, we can get a bunch of dirt and crud and stuff in there. It's really important to blow those out too, right?
Yes, yes. And again, the dielectric solvent works really well. You know, you use an air compressor and you blow all the dirt out of the fan. And, you know, if you've got a drive on it, open the drive up, make sure the fan's inside the drive are blown out. And, you know, any place, you know, where you've got air moving through something, blow it out really well. Those fins that are on the outside of the motor and the fins that are on the outside of the drive, they're there for a reason, to dissipate heat. But if you cover them up and you plug them full of dirt, guess what? They don't dissipate heat because they don't get any radiant airflow, or not radiant, convection currents through those fins, and that's how they cool. I like a little bit of dielectric solvent up underneath the fan wheel, up underneath that fan on top of the motor or on the end of the motor, to get the crud that gets underneath there out of there. you know, spray it in there and start the motor up and let it spin the crud out. And you'd be surprised how much dirt gets built up underneath between that fan and the top of the motor housing, which can actually put drag on the rotor and cause the motor to start drawing high amperage.
Mm-hmm.
So just the little things that you learn over the period of time, whether it's, you know, a totally enclosed fan cooled motor, a TEFC, or an ODP, you know, and an ODP motor, of course, the fan is internally, but blow the end bell of the motor out where the fan is and get all the crud out of there. Which reminds me of something. When you grease motors, if you've got greasable bearings on the motor, you got a grease fitting on the top of the bearing, and you've got a plug on the opposite side of the bearing. Take the plug out before you start shoving grease in there. Because if you don't, the way a bearing is made, you know, you've got the outer race, you've got the inner race, you've got the balls or the sphericals in there that take the friction out of it, and that cavity is what's filled with grease. Well, the problem is they put two dust covers over the bearing to keep the dust out of the rotating element of the bearing. Well, those little rotating covers are just snapped in place. They're just little plastic dust covers. Well, if I don't take the relief plug out of the bottom of the motor and I start pumping grease in there, that hydraulic gun's got enough pressure, it'll just pop those little plastic covers right off of there. Mm-hmm. Now you just open the bearing up to whatever dirt is in the airstream. The other problem is when you do that and you start pumping grease in there, now you start to fill the end bell up of the motor. And as you put all this excess grease in there, it gets around that bearing. And now you can't dissipate heat. It acts as an insulator and it holds the heat in the bearing. It's the quickest way to bearing failure. This is one of the downsides to doing a podcast. If I was doing this live and in person, I'd show you pictures of some that I've taken apart that have, I found one that had almost three tubes of grease inside the end bell of the motor.
Send me the pictures and I'll post them up.
Okay. Yeah, I'll send them to you. It's unbelievable what happens when you don't grease a motor correctly. And so it's one of those things that guys seem to think, oh, okay, well, you know, if one pump's good, three pumps is better. It's not. It really isn't.
I was going to ask you about over-greasing because I don't know how many times I've gone to a bearing to do a maintenance and there's like just grease oozing like out every cavity of the bearing. I'm like, holy grease balls.
Yeah. And the other thing is one of the things that happens is you have to pay attention to what type of grease you're using. So if you've got a belt drive fan and you've got bearings on the fan and you've got bearings in the motor, did you know it's not the same type of grease for the fan bearings as it is for the motor bearings? It's two different types of grease because they have different temperature ratings. And most of the motors out there use an EM rated grease, EM standing for electric motor. And literally every manufacturer, every motor manufacturer out there, Polyrex EM is the most common one, but there's a whole bunch of them. There's all kinds of EM rated greases from Lubriplate and Mobil and, you know, all the different grease manufacturers. But fan bearings have a different rating. And you have to look at the individual bearing. Is it a split pillow block? Is it a conventional pillow block? You know, what type of bearing it is to know what the grease is supposed to be. And every manufacturer will tell you when you grease that bearing, you want to grease it until you barely get a little bitty film of grease coming out around that snap-in cover. Because that tells you the bearing's full.
Yeah.
Now there are some bearings, some big fan bearings that have a grease relief plug on them that you pull the plug out and you push, take the old grease out, push new grease in. But those are some really specialized, massive pillow block bearings when you get into really big industrial fans.
And there's some pillow blocks. I've made this mistake, but I stopped making this mistake once I learned the difference. There's some pillow blocks that I've bought that they don't come with the Zerk fitting. like the grease nipple or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. It's just got a cap there. You can take the cap out, but it's a sealed bearing. There's right. no, even if you, even some guys are like taking those off and putting the fittings on and greasing it, but the grease isn't going into the actual bearing because it's sealed. It's right. not going, it's not doing anything. So I've seen this a lot too. And just figure out if that bearing is a sealed bearing or it's not a seal. Because if it's a sealed bearing, putting a fitting on and greasing it is doing nothing for it.
Right. You're wasting your time. And you can't tell until you pull the little plastic cap out of there and look down in there. And are you looking at the bearing or are you looking at the steel of the bearing housing?
Yeah.
You know, exactly. And I mean, I've taken a pocket screwdriver and dropped in there to see, you know, because if you're looking at the bearing, you should have, there should be a clearance volume, a little bit of clearance in there that you can drop down in there. And you usually see a little bit of grease or some sheen to it that it's the bearing. Because the bearing itself, you're usually nice and shiny and pretty and all that. And if nothing else, if you're going to replace the bearings, there should have been an instruction sheet that came with the bearing. Read it. You know, God forbid we pick up the IOM and read the thing.
Yeah.
That's always surprised me about service guys. Have service guys forgotten how to read? Or do they just think, I've been doing this for 20 years or 10 years or 30 years or whatever it is, and I don't need to read the instructions?
So here's the thing about that. And I know this podcast is about starting. We've gone on tangents, but I think they're all related. Like we talked about bearings for 5 or 6 minutes, but that's related to startup and they're important. But this is what I see from being online and taking comments from people. There's too many people, and it scares me about how they go about their own day in the life of the trade. Because there's too many people with tunnel vision that make too many assumptions. So I posted up an install. It was a heat pump. It was an air handler hanging in a basement. And it was vertical. And people are like, well, that's not going to pass code. I'm like, why? Well, you can't put an air handler in an attic without a pan underneath it. And I said, it's not in an attic. It's in a basement. Why don't you ask me where it's installed first before you start telling me what? And especially it's your code in your state where you live or your wherever you live. It's not code everywhere. So right. ask where it's installed, how it's installed, and then make your comment. Don't just assume that it's installed 5 minutes down the road from your house. You know what I mean? Right. And it's this tunnel vision that drives me insane. Because if you have that kind of tunnel vision looking at a picture online, what kind of tunnel vision do you have when you go out and do your own work, especially service work? Are right. you a parts changer? Do you go to the part that's clicking? And maybe it's not that part. Maybe it's clicking because something down there is causing it to. Full picture diagnostic, full picture, non-assuming sort of approach to everything. And I, it drives me insane with the way these people assume online.
Right. Well, here's, you know, when I look at that and we talk about, you know, heating startups and equipment startups, read the IOM. The IOM has a detailed sequence of operation that starts when the thermostat calls for heat. It tells you everything that's going to happen. You know, we'll pick on a residential 95% efficient gas furnace. Hey, you get a call for heat. First thing that's going to happen is the inducer fan is going to start. Well, if it's a no heat call and the thermostat calls for heat and the inducer fan doesn't start up, what's ahead of the inducer fan that would cause it not to start? Mm-hmm. You know, it's understanding the sequence of operation and understanding how to pick the wiring diagram up and read the wiring diagram. Figure out, okay, there's my inducer fan. Oh, there's a relay in there that's got to turn that inducer fan on. Let me go back and look at that relay and make sure that relay's functional. Now, mm-hmm. If it's a printed circuit board, you're kind of stuck with replacing the board, but is it or isn't it? You know, and make sure you know what's happening. Put your meter on the inducer fan. Maybe you're getting 120 volts to the inducer fan and it's a bad motor or it's stuck. You know, the downside to inducer fans is because of the corrosive nature of flue gas, especially in a condensing furnace, you can get some rust buildup in there, you know, around the shaft, and you get dirt there. And there's actually nothing wrong with the inducer fan. It's just gotten cruddy. And if you take it apart and you clean it, all of a sudden, magically, everything works again. And instead of a $300 repair bill, they've got a $100 repair bill. It's little things like that that, you know, you got to understand what the equipment's supposed to do before you can go back and troubleshoot it.
Yeah.
Because if you don't know what's supposed to happen when, how do you know where it's broke? And that's all part and parcel with going through the startup and making sure everything happens the way it's supposed to.
Yes, correct.
And, you know, and it doesn't make any difference whether it's a boiler or an air handler or a rooftop unit or a heat pump. They all have a defined sequence of operation. Follow it and make sure everything happens the way it's supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, and once you do that, now you know, okay, I know where it can fail.
Yep. And stop assuming and stop having tunnel vision.
Right.
Moral of the story. So I'm going to have to run in a couple of minutes because I actually have a tube heater that is shooting fire out of the tube reported by the customer. So
they've
shut it off. So they need that inspected plus a bunch of other tube heaters as well. So just goes back to guys, gals out there, educate your customers on heating startups before it gets cold outside.
Right.
I mean, I understand we get super busy and the tail end of the summer could be hot and we might have all these lingering calls and stuff to get to for cooling. But if there's an opportunity, get your customers on an educated service plant, like educate them first, get them on some sort of, hey, let's check your furnace or let's check your rooftop, your boiler, whatever it may be, before it gets cold outside. A lot of companies, they'll go in and they'll tear down, they'll do most of their boiler maintenance in the summer, which is incredible. It's hot outside in July. Let's tear this boiler down, clean it, get it all up and ready. So, and then you could maybe fire it for 5 minutes or something like that. You know what I mean? Nothing crazy, but know that it actually will fire up after you're done your work. So when that cold day strikes in October, we're not rushing around trying to figure out what's going on and ordering parts and we have an emergency on our hands. So if
exactly.
You can do that, all the better.
Exactly. You know, it's be prepared and educate your customers, but also educate yourself. And don't think that education stops just because you got out of trade school. Keep going back to school. You know, even if it's a 1 hour presentation, you know, or a 2 hour presentation at the local supply house on the latest and greatest tube joining method that, oh, I know all that stuff. Go sit through it anyway. You'd be surprised what little thing you might pick up.
I've been to like six to maybe, no, probably more than that, seven or eight since I went out on my own because the company I was with, I mean, they didn't really send us on stuff like this, which is a shame, to be honest with you. But since I've been on my own, the first 3 days of being on my own was a 3-day training course on heat pumps.
Yep.
And it was fabulous. And I've been to seven or eight since then, little manufacturer half day sort of training courses and stuff. And it's amazing what you pick up and it's amazing the networking you create, the people you talk to. People have questions that you may not even have thought of that get answered in these little trainings, and it just keeps you on top of the game. That's all.
Yep. You can never ever have too much training.
No, you can't. Anyway, man, I'm gonna have to run. Tony,
okay.
This has been excellent. I really appreciate it, man. And as always, your insight, your experience here is really helped a lot.
Gary, as always, it's been fun. And I enjoy doing these with you and your audience. I keep recommending your podcast to lots of people. I'm hearing feedback from different guys I know that they absolutely love it. They enjoy all the stuff that you talk about. And you do a great job of keeping the masses educated.
I try. Frustratingly, I try.
I understand.
Anyway, I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole. Anyway, okay, Tony, thank you very much.
Thanks, Gary.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm supposed to hit stop. I just tried to leave.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Follow HVAC Know-It-All on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, Twitter, LinkedIn, and anywhere else Gary feels like popping up. This has been a Two Smokes and a Coffee production.